Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an emergency room physician who was working at the University of Colorado Hospital in Aurora on the night 12 people were killed and 70 injured at the Colorado Movie Theater in 2012, and speak with Dr. Kamina Sasson, who is the Vice President for Science and Innovation at the American Heart Association, who also serves as the Chair of the Partnership of Academics and Communities in Transition for the University of Colorado. She joins us to discuss how, while there were no wounded in the gun massacre at the supermarket in Boulder on Monday, the kinds of wounds from assault rifles that she has dealt with are so traumatic that there can be no possible justification for this kind of firepower designed for the battlefield to be available to be unleashed on the streets of America. We assess why people feel the need to open carry this kind of firepower and what it is that they are so afraid of to feel the need to dress up with body armor, tactical gear, and camo in the land of the free when clearly they are not pursuing happiness, but in fact are endangering life and liberty. Then we'll get an assessment of what the Biden administration might do in response to the latest gun massacre, given the president's call to bring back the assault weapons ban. The author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea, Joshua Horwitz, the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence, joins us to discuss the slim chances of getting anything passed in the Senate, while at the state level, much progress is being made even in states like Virginia, the home of the NRA. Then finally, we'll speak with Ellie Honig, a former assistant United States attorney with the Southern District of New York, about the referral today of Michael Sherwin to the Department of Justice's Office of Professional Responsibility following the former D.C. U.S. attorney's unauthorized appearance on 60 Minutes. We'll discuss the extent to which Sherwin has made it more difficult to prosecute the rioters who stormed the Capitol, and whether the Oath Keepers and Giuliani, assuming he will be held to account for inciting insurrection, can now argue the jury pool has been tainted. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. Joining us now, Dr. Kamina Sasson, who is a Vice President of Science and Innovation for Emergency Cardiovascular Care at the American Heart Association, who also serves as the Chair of the Partnership of Academics and Communities in Transition for the University of Colorado. In 2012, she was working as an emergency room doctor at the University of Colorado Hospital in Aurora the night that 12 people were killed and 70 injured at a Colorado movie theater. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Kamina Sasson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And this horrible incident that took place on Monday in Boulder with 10 people killed, I guess the difference in the sense of what you experienced in Aurora was there were 70 wounded. As far as I can tell, was anybody wounded in this latest mass shooting?
You know, I was working a shift on that day and I was glued to my phone watching the live stream, waiting for the ambulances to leave the parking lot full of victims, just as they had done during the theater shooting that had happened many years ago for the Aurora shooting, and they never left. They were just there. And I think that was what was so striking, was that there weren't really many folks, as far as I can tell, who were wounded. I think there was just casualties.
Well, that would indicate that the shooter was shooting people pretty much at point blank range. We don't know the details, but what we know so far is pretty gruesome. Apparently, The first person was shot outside the supermarket in the parking lot, and then he was shot again, and then everybody in the supermarket saw it through the windows, at least a lot of them did, and then there was absolute panic as this guy walks in and starts shooting people. So I guess the connection, if there is one, Dr. Sasson, is that the shooter in Aurora was manifestly mentally ill, and now we're getting reports that this particular shooter may have also had psychological problems.
Yeah, you know, again, this is all based off of reports that I'm hearing as well, so I don't have any direct knowledge, per se, of the shooter's mental health issues or concerns. But from what I've read, yes, I do think that there are some mental health issues. And again, anyone who would do such a horrible thing and commit such atrocious crimes, I think, would have to be mentally ill. I think all of us can agree to that. You know, I think the other thing that is very similar, and again, one of the things that I was watching in horror a few days ago, watching this all unfold, was, you know, the assault rifle, right? I think the number of people who were shot and killed in such a short amount of time, the amount of mass destruction that was done in such a quick amount of time, that was something very similar to what happened again in Aurora, Colorado.
And the weapon was a Ruger AR-556 pistol with an arm brace, and it was purchased on March the 16th. So there again, going back to Aurora, it does seem that we still have a problem, that people, not that, I think the Aurora shooter was already in psychiatric care, was he not? But this particular person, according to his older brother, did seem to have some issues, but it doesn't seem like he was in any way treated. So we still have this problem in this country, surely, with people who should not get guns having access to them.
Absolutely. And I will say, as an emergency department physician, there are many folks who I take care of who have mental health issues who come in seeking care. You know, I can do my best to take care of them, and oftentimes we're able to get them resources, but there's also many folks who aren't able to access the healthcare system, or who maybe are mentally ill and don't have the ability to even recognize that they need help. And so, again, I think we've got an issue in that you have to be able to be diagnosed to know that you have mental health concerns. You have to be able to access the healthcare system to be able to get the treatment that you need. And then you have to be able to afford that treatment as well, and to be able to stay in continued treatment. And then, of course, we have the added issue in the U.S. particularly, that we don't have a lot of safeguards in place right now in terms of being able to identify those folks who are mentally ill, who should not have access to guns. And I do strongly believe that there are folks who should not have guns. And we know some of those people because of their pattern of behavior. And then there's some folks like, you know, potentially like this person, who maybe didn't have a longstanding record of psychiatric illness. And that's where, you know, I think it becomes very challenging and very difficult, especially as a medical provider, to say, hey, look, what could we have done differently? How has the system failed? You know, when I look at what happened a few days ago, I don't think to myself, you know, gosh, this is just another thing, you know, another mass shooting, thoughts and prayers were done. I think to myself, my God, this can't happen again. This absolutely cannot happen again. We are in a crisis situation. This is not political. This is public health. This is public safety. This is the fact that people don't feel safe walking into the grocery store anymore. You know, and I think we've gotten to the point now where we have to figure out ways that are evidence-based solutions to figure out how to make sure to prevent this from ever happening. And we have ways to do that. We just need to figure out how to do it and to do it consistently.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Camilla Sasson, who's the Vice President for Science and Innovation for Emergency Cardiovascular Care at the American Heart Association, who also serves as the Chair of the Partnership of Academics and Communities in Transition for the University of Colorado. In 2012, she was working as an emergency room doctor at the University of Colorado Hospital in Aurora the night that 12 people were killed and 70 injured in the Colorado movie theater. And one of the young people that were killed, his father is a member of the state legislature, is he not, Sullivan? And he's been leading the charge, it seems, on getting some sensible gun safety laws passed, although there was a setback. The city of Boulder did have an ordinance preventing people from buying and carrying assault rifles like the one that the shooter used on Monday at the supermarket in Boulder. That was recently struck down by the state court. So are you familiar with the work of the father of one of the victims of Aurora?
I am, yeah. I actually know him personally as well. It's a small network of folks who all still very much are in touch with each other because, again, I think we feel very passionately about the fact that there are things that we should be doing to make sure that these types of mass shootings don't ever happen again.
So what are you up against? Because only recently the NRA was celebrating what they called a victory in having this Boulder City ordinance struck down.
I will be honest, as an ER doctor, I can tell you I have seen the destruction that assault rifles cause on the human body, right? I have seen what happens when people get shot in close proximity in a short period of time, how much destruction can happen to the human body with an assault rifle. And I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt that there is no reason that somebody who is acting in a way that they are legally carrying a firearm and want to go hunting or want to carry it for a purpose that is not to cause mass destruction, that they would need an assault rifle. I don't understand it. I don't get it. I will be very honest. As an ER doctor, I don't see why anyone needs to carry an assault rifle. The amount of destruction that happens to the human body, the amount of people you can kill in such a short amount of time, I don't get it. I don't understand it. And so I don't see why there has to be a rule that allows people, why we allow people to carry them around. I will be very honest with you. I think sensible gun reform is, hey, look, if you want to carry a gun and you have a license and you are, you know, properly vetted and you've had background checks, okay, I'm okay with that. But an assault rifle, I don't understand who needs one and for what purpose other than what we've seen, which is mass destruction and loss of life in a way that is, quite honestly, I think unnerving to all of us because we don't feel safe going to school, going to work, going to pray, going to the grocery store, doing any of the things that we think are should be commonplace.
And of course, those that advocate for the proliferation of firearms, in particular assault rifles, like the NRA, in fact, on the day of the tragedy in Boulder, the NRA tweeted out the text of the Second Amendment, which says, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, citizens' right to bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, the context for that, the preamble is a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. Well, you've just pointed out that we are neither secure or free. Can proponents of gun safety turn that argument against the NRA? It would seem to me that any reading of the Second Amendment would indicate that is what it's all about, more than the idea that anybody can have an assault rifle.
It doesn't make sense to me that a normal person, you know, like I would have no inclination whatsoever of understanding why somebody would need to buy an assault rifle right now, quite honestly, other than to think that, you know, that something bad would happen, right? Because again, I don't understand what you would need. What is the purpose of carrying something that can cause that much destruction in that much time, right? In such a short period of time. And so again, in a military setting, in a setting in which it is needed, absolutely, yes, it should be allowed. But in a setting, in a grocery store where it's used to kill innocent people, if you look at many of the mass shootings that have happened across the country over the last decade, many of those have happened because of assault rifles. And again, that's because if you have a short amount of time, which is usually what happens because someone calls 911 and the police or the authorities, first responders come on scene, you can only kill that many people in that short amount of time if you have the ability to carry a large volume of bullets and have the ability to essentially shoot that many bullets in that short amount of time. And to do it sort of, I would say, in a way in which you can cause that much destruction. And that's what these high volume assault rifles can do. And I've seen it on the other side, right? So I've taken care of the victims of of gun violence. And not just assault rifles. I've taken care of victims of gun violence from other types of guns as well. And it's a completely different situation when I took care of those patients from the Aurora shooting. The types of injuries that they had, the level of severity of injuries that they had is so completely different than anything I'd ever seen in my career. And I've trained in urban areas. I've trained in, you know, level one trauma centers, county hospitals, you know, in some of the roughest neighborhoods ever. But the type of injuries I saw that night were, and the number of people that I saw in such a short amount of time, I've never seen in my career before.
And Dr. Sasson, short of the shooters like the Aurora shooter and the Boulder shooter and others in El Paso, for example, they all used assault rifles, as did the Sandy Hook shooter. Short of that, those Americans that showed up, that show up in, for example, in the Michigan State House carrying assault rifles and do these open carry protests, when I look at those men with their guns and their tactical vests, and by the way, the shooter in Boulder did have a tactical vest on, apparently, and their full military gear, they seem to be sort of looking like sort of weekend warriors out on some fantasy that they're about to take on a real enemy. But where's the real enemy in America? Why do these men feel so insecure that they need all of this firepower? What is it about our society that creates a mental condition where you think you need to defend yourself against what?
I think you've asked the question that a lot of us are thinking of right now, right? I think as we, you know, put our children in our cars and let them out into their schools and wonder if they're going to come back to us at the end of the day. I think when we walk into the grocery store for milk and look around us and start thinking, okay, you know, does anybody look strange around us or suspicious? I mean, that level of uncertainty, that level of fear that I think many of us right now are feeling, because I can't get inside of the head of somebody who carries an assault rifle and wears tactical gear and thinks that it's fun or it's a great show of force or look, I'm asserting my independent rights and you can't tell me what to do. You know, I'll be honest, I don't understand that. And I can't even pretend to understand why they're doing that. I understand the need for independence. I understand the need for people wanting to feel like they can make their own decisions. Absolutely. But I will tell you from the perspective of a physician, of an ER doc who oftentimes sees the aftermath and the after effects of people making poor decisions or having decisions made for them that now are going to result in loss of life or limb, I can tell you very much so that this is an issue of public health and public safety. And sometimes we have to help people make the right decisions. And I feel that strongly about even our COVID-19 pandemic that we're having right now. You know, all of a sudden, wearing a mask is a political statement. We're burning masks everywhere. We're telling people vaccines are not safe. I mean, you know, I think at the end of the day, I think we have to stop politicizing guns and vaccines and masks and just remember that at the end of the day, what we're trying to say is, hey, look, what we're trying to do is just make it safe for you, me, my neighbors, your kids, everybody's safety is really what we're concerned about. And we're just asking you to please help us help you. And that's the perspective I'm using. And we have to stop making it political or else we're never going to get to a common ground. And if it's always going to be about independent choice and don't tell me what to do, well, guess what? We live in a world where we have to be able to follow some rules. And we follow those rules every day. When I stop at a stop sign, I don't blow through the stop sign because I decided I don't feel like following the rules today. I do it because I know if I want to keep my driver's license and I want to make sure I don't run somebody over, I follow the rules. And guess what? There are some rules that are made to be helpful to make sure the rest of us are safe. And I think in this case, in the sense of assault rifles, I think not having those out on the streets and making sure that we have better safeguards in place to make sure that mentally ill folks don't have access to guns, making sure that background checks are happening every single time and that there aren't loopholes. I think those are all common sense things that we should be able to say are going to be better for all of us to keep us all safe. I think wearing a mask and ideally getting vaccinated to help keep you safe and to keep me safe and to keep our grandparents safe and to get our economy back and to get our businesses open and our schools open, that's going to keep us all safe. And so I would hope that we can not make this about politics and we can make this about public health and public safety.
Well, just in closing, do you think there would be a role, an educational role, for starting to teach young boys? I mean, in our culture, going back to the Western movies, there's the idea that the gun, not just in Westerns, but in detectives and all these TV shows you see, there's always some young female detective pointing a gun at you, you know, a huge gun usually. So there's this sense in our culture that guns solve problems. And it seems to me that if there's a way to sort of not so much demystify them, but to make them seem they're not instruments of power, they're instruments of cowardice. This is nothing to be proud of. This is nothing that makes you a man. It makes you, you know, a coward. I mean, in a way, I know I'm sort of grasping here at straws, but do you have any sense that there's a non-political educational process that might be useful?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, again, if we think of it as a one size fits all or one solution fits all, you know, I think we're going to miss the boat. And so I do think public education is part of it. And I do think, you know, I think one of those things is just recognizing the need for help. Right. And so recognizing that maybe there is something going on and destigmatizing accessing mental health resources. I think that's one thing. I think being able to, you know, as a mother of a son, now he's 6 years old, I think not fantasizing or making guns be cool or neat or fun or hip or powerful weapons. I think those are things that I try to do on a day-to-day basis with my son and my daughter. To, you know, when they start doing, you know, cops and robbers and things like that, I sort of shield them from that, or I try to move them to a different kind of game and things like that. You know, so I think there's small little things that we can do as parents that can have a big impact on the way in which we raise our children. But I do think there's a broader scale public education effort that needs to happen, really also just around the idea of what is power? What does it mean to, you know, I think there's, if you look at some of the issues that we're having right now in our inner cities and in, you know, what's happening, for example, in Chicago, that's a city that I grew up in and I've lived 20 plus years in, and it has become one of the most challenging cities to live in, you know, to go downtown and to be able to walk without feeling a little bit unsafe in some of the neighborhoods. And I think, you know, we have to think about what is contributing to the increase in gun violence. Is it a lack of, you know, is it a lack of jobs? Is it a lack of resources? Is it people with idle time? Is it gangs? Is it drugs? Is it, you know, what is the contributor to this violence? Because again, if we don't understand the root causes of this and we don't really educate and try to fix those root causes, we're going to be having the same conversations, I dare to say, not a year from now, probably tomorrow, because it's just going to be the same thing over and over again. And quite honestly, I'm tired of thoughts and prayers, because those are so important. But at the end of the day, we got to fix this. We know we can fix this. And as an ER doc, I'll tell you, my job is not to my job is to fix things. And oftentimes we can prevent most of the things that I have to see in the ED to fix. So we just got to figure out how to fix it, and we got to prevent it.
Well, Dr. Camilla Sasson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me. And I really hope we can do more together and to really end this gun violence issue, because, again, this is destroying not just our communities, but also I think for many of us, it's destroying our sense of safety and personal safety. And I think that's going to have some long lasting effects on all of us, too.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Camilla Sasson, who's the Vice President for Science and Innovation for Emergency Cardiovascular Care at the American Heart Association, who also serves as the Chair of the Partnership of Academics and Communities in Transition for the University of Colorado. In 2012, she was working as an emergency room doctor at the University of Colorado Hospital in Aurora the night that 12 people were killed and 70 injured at the Colorado movie theater. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an assessment of what the Biden administration might do in response to the latest gun massacre, given the president's call to bring back the assault weapons ban.
And there's kids playing guns in the street. and one's pointing his tree branch at me. So I put my hands up, I say enough is enough. If you walk away, I'll walk away. And he shot me dead. I found a liquid cure from my landlocked blues.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Joshua Horwitz, who is the Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He has spent more than two decades working on gun violence prevention issues and is the author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Horwitz.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And on Tuesday, President Biden said we can ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines in this country once again. I got it done when I was a senator. It passed. It was a law for the longest time, and it brought down these mass killings. We should do it again. So that's the intention, but the reality is that even after Sandy Hook, when President Obama got very emotionally involved, and Pat Toomey and Joe Manchin did a bipartisan attempt to do something, and it was very, very minor stuff that they were proposing, and they couldn't even get that through the GOP Senate, and that was when the NRA was riding high. Is there a different situation now, even though the Democrats are holding on by their fingernails in terms of controlling the Senate? Is there something different now vis-a-vis the, at least the power of the NRA that could make something possible?
Well, first, let's start with this, that the NRA is a lot less powerful. In fact, they're the weakest I've ever seen them in my over 30-year career. They've been involved in a number of different scandals, including, you know, the sort of Paola scandal where they're clearly ripping off their members. They've been involved and they got infiltrated by a Russian spy, the Maria Butina scandal, and they're in bankruptcy. So they're as weak as they've ever been before. That being said, the Republican Party as a whole has gone even further to the right than where we were post Sandy Hook. And so while there are some folks who might vote for something like some senators who might vote for a background check, I think it's going to be very difficult to get an assault weapons ban through the Senate. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, because I believe in holding people accountable for their votes and reminding people where the opposition is. So I do hope that we try to do that, and my organization will work as hard as we can to get H.R. 8, the background check bill, through, an assault weapons ban through, also closing the Charleston loophole so people who have an inconclusive background check don't have access to firearms. There's a lot that we'll try to do, and some of that may pass, but also very importantly is holding our elected officials, our senators, accountable so we know where they stand. A lot of senators, especially the Republican Party, will talk a good game about not wanting to see this happen again, but I want them on the record, and I think that's how you hold people accountable. And one of the biggest ways we get change in America is through the election. That's number one. Number two is, what we're not seeing in the debate in Congress, which tends to be stalled, is the remarkable progress we've made in the states. Not enough. It's too slow. But the landscape at the state level is drastically changing. Not enough, but there are some big changes. I spend a lot of time building state. We've spent a lot of time passing state laws, building state infrastructure. And we think that that's actually one of the best ways to make Congress move, is by making the states they came from move on issues. So it's a long haul. I wish it was faster. It's maddeningly slow. And when you see the terrible tragedies of the last week, and you know, our deepest sympathies go out to the families both in Atlanta and in Boulder, it's just hard to understand why we don't get progress. But as you know, the Senate is in many ways an anti-majoritarian body. And unfortunately, in this role, they're doing that. But I ask your listeners to think clearly and about how much progress we're making in the states. And then for your listeners in California, how much progress specifically we've made in California.
Well, in terms of H.R. 8, though, the most moderate member of the Democratic caucus in the Senate, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, said on Tuesday that that bill that the House passed on firearms, gun safety, went too far.
Yeah, I'm not here to tell you that the Senate is going to dramatically change what they've been doing in the past. They've been very recalcitrant, and I do think putting people on the record for not supporting what the 80 or 90% of Americans want is very important. I will say to you, and especially to your listeners, Congress is completely dysfunctional. It's a fact, and it's very unfortunate, and it's beyond guns. But your state legislatures still work. And that's what we're spending a lot of time with. And it's going to be slow change. And I think for people who are looking at this today and looking at the unbelievable sadness and carnage and how communities are ruined, it's just not a satisfactory answer. But the reality is, and it's horrible to watch what's going on. But the reality is, to make progress, we're going to need to do it by building and succeeding with robust policy change at the states. And that's what I focus on right now. We do a lot of federal legislation. I work on it, but Congress is in many ways dysfunctional, and that happens here. I will say that the Biden administration actually has a number of things they can do through executive action. So they could definitely tomorrow ban ghost guns, which are these guns that are made out of kits, which is very important. They could work on some enforcement issues. They could make more money available for enforcement and also for suicide prevention. They can make more money available to stem the tide of community violence. And we're here talking today about in the aftermath of mass shootings, but in communities across the country, there's a mass shooting every day. We lose 100 people to gun violence every day in America. We lose 60 people to gun suicide, 40 people to gun homicide. And so we need to be working on this, at all the time, not just in the wake of a mass shooting. And there are things that we can do, but I know for a listener and for me, it is just very frustrating that the political system in our country is not up to the task. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, and that doesn't mean that we can't make great progress with the states as we are doing.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Horwitz, who's the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He spent more than 2 decades working on gun violence prevention issues and is the author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. And in terms of the White House, they're apparently mulling over executive orders. And the press secretary said that Joe Biden is not waiting for anything to fail in Congress. She said our team is looking at now is a range of legislation out now and whether there's policy gaps need to be filled or can be revisited, and we should address community violence and a range of issues that are the root causes and lead to the deaths and impacts we're seeing that is very troubling. No one is talking about overturning or changing the Second Amendment. What our focus is on is putting in place common sense measures that will make our communities safer. So do you think there's you mentioned some of the things he could do, Biden, with executive orders. How long do you think he's going to give the Congress then, and the Senate in particular? Obviously, the House have passed these bills. It's up to the Senate.
Look, I personally hope he acts independently and he acts tomorrow or today on these executive orders. I think he's waited too long already. Biden has been a big supporter of gun violence prevention, but there are things that are right within his power to do. He could, like I said, he could direct the ATF to ban ghost guns tomorrow. These are guns that are untraceable, and they're more and more likely to be showing up at crime scenes. Number two, he could tomorrow direct grant programs, direct the funding in the federal government, direct some of the programs coming out of the Justice Department to fund community violence intervention immediately. We do know that there's a number of great programs that focus on the people most at risk for violence in communities, help them with services, supplying violence intervention and interruption services. These programs work, and they could be, we need a lot more funding for them. He could do that tomorrow. The other thing is, we know that there's a lot of action that can be done on suicide prevention. And I want to remind the reader, the listeners, that while while we see these mass shootings and how tragic and awful and public they are, every day in America, 60 Americans are going to die by firearm suicide. And one of the most important things we can do is get guns out of their hands when they're most at risk for harming themselves. And there's a couple ways to do that. And there's a couple of things that can be done right now. Number one, we can spend money and training on what's called lethal means safety counseling. And that is for physicians and other people healthcare providers and other people interacting with people who are at risk. There's training and resources that can be done right now. Number two, the Extreme Risk Protection Order. That's a law now in 19 states in the District of Columbia that allows family members, law enforcement, in some states, healthcare providers, to remove firearms with the judge's consent from people at risk. These laws are saving lives every single day, and the federal government can help with best practices, training. They can incentivize other states to adopt them. So there's a lot to do that can be effective right today. I know it's frustrating that these mass shootings keep developing. And there are some things that the president can't do, like ban assault weapons. However, there is a lot the administration can do. I think the administration should act immediately and also push for votes in Congress on the background check bill, H.R. 8, the assault weapons ban, the Charleston loophole. And if they can't get what they want, put people on record so that we know exactly who the people are who are stopping good policy moving forward and who are allowing this terrible mayhem to continue.
Well, what's extraordinary about the year 2020, the year of COVID, is that at least 43,436 Americans died from gun violence in 2020, and that included 20,000 people died from shootings and nearly 24,000 people died from gun-related suicide. So it's extraordinary. And, of course, I believe people are buying guns more than ever, or at least they have been in this last year. So that seems to be the pattern. Is there any chance of sort of demystifying? I mean, I know that the Second Amendment is totally misinterpreted. It has been since the Heller decision, because the predicate is that a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. Well, we're not secure and we're not free. That's obvious. If we can't go to the mall, we can't go to the movies, kids can't go to school safely, and people now can't shop in supermarkets. I mean, it's getting worse and worse. But what about the idea of changing the kind of dialogue about these people that want to strut their stuff and have open carry, and the ones that showed up at the Michigan State House with assault rifles? Is there any way for us to sort of collectively ask those people, why in this country do you need to have military weapons in everyday life? What is it that you're afraid of?
Well, so we can ask them and we can try to change the dialogue, or we can change policy. And I can tell you that policy changes is possible, especially at the state level. So I live and work in Virginia, and I've done a lot of my work at the legislature there the last over 20 years. And Virginia is the home, the home to the NRA, although they're trying to leave. It was very similar to Congress in that 4 years ago, you would have never believed that a gun violence prevention law would get through the Virginia General Assembly. But in the last 2 years, because we changed the legislators, we've got about 20 gun violence prevention bills through. And one of those things is a ban on open carry at the Capitol. And so when you see what happened at the Michigan legislature, that will not happen in Virginia because it's now illegal to open carry onto Capitol Square in Virginia. So policy change is possible through determined advocacy. I think dialoguing with anybody is a good idea, but what I found is that it is for people who believe that open carry is a God-given right and they should be able to carry anywhere they want, that dialogue isn't necessarily always the answer. I think dialoguing and finding people who are, who can create a coalition to make change, and that means people who support people like me who are adamant supporters of gun violence prevention, but also there's a lot of people in the middle who are just sort of sick of seeing, you know, armed insurrectionists marching through the streets, marching through the at the Capitol, destroying and injuring, you know, Capitol, you know, killing people at the Capitol. And so I think you're actually, when you talk about things like open carry, when you talk about banning guns at the Capitols, I think you actually have people who are willing to do those things. So I think it's always important to dialogue. But for me, it's not dialogue. It's building coalitions of and finding those right solutions. Background checks, I think, is one of those. And we passed that in Virginia, limiting where you can have open carry. We've done that and concealed carry in Virginia. We've been able to do that. So I think that's important. As far as changing the, you know, as far as you mentioned the people purchasing firearms, you know, that it's a really dangerous thing. We've had in the last 18 months a record, really in the last year, record firearm sales, which means more guns in the homes of people across the country, more opportunity to do bad things with those firearms, but also more opportunity for family members and loved ones who are feeling low, who for whatever reason might be having suicidal ideation, to quickly end their own lives. And I am begging people who have brought their new guns into their homes to keep those guns locked and secure, to think hard about whether you really need that firearm. Because what we're seeing now is an unbelievable increase in the volume of firearms in homes, the access to firearms, and that's why you're seeing the death rate go up so dramatically. There's a real strong correlation, especially with suicide, to access to firearms and guns in the home. And we need, for people who are first-time gun owners, I certainly understand uncertainty. I certainly understand being scared. But when I look at the data, I'm scared for my own family, for other people's families with easy access to firearms, especially with young people in the homes.
Well, just in the last minute, Josh, what happened to the original assault weapons ban that was pushed through the Senate by Senator Feinstein? And Biden, of course, mentioned it, that he helped get it passed. There was a sunset clause in it, wasn't there? Why was that?
Right.
Why would you do that in a bill? I mean,
So I was around when that passed, and that passed in 1994. And to get the last couple of votes, the Democratic senators need to put a clause that said this ban will expire after 10 years. And I think the idea behind that was, people will be, you know, after 10 years, the Congress will be much more amenable to gun violence prevention policy. But that didn't happen. Our country has become more fractious on this nature, on this issue. I think that the elected Republicans, and I don't mean all Republicans, I certainly don't mean all gun owners, have been much more recalcitrant on this. And so that ban expired, which was really unfortunate.
Well, Joshua Horowitz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure.
Well, thanks again. And I've been speaking with Joshua Horowitz, who's the Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He has spent more than two decades working on gun violence prevention issues and is the author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the former D.C. U.S. Attorney's unauthorized appearance on 60 Minutes will make it more difficult to prosecute the rioters who stormed the Capitol.
It's like being on trial for your life with a public defender. Let the jury fill the seats up and start the court calendar off with docket number 9mm. All rise, the Honorable Jay-Z preside. Instead of a mallet, I hold a tool. All objections overruled. Save your opening arguments. Hope you understand it. Two guns, right over left. That's how I cross-examine. Like Tom Cruise, popping with the top gun. You lose. No lie, and y'all can't handle the truth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ellie Honig, who served as an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York for 8 years and as director of the Division of Criminal Justice at the Office of the Attorney General of the State of New Jersey for 5 years. He's currently executive director at Rutgers Institute for Secure Communities and a legal analyst for CNN, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, Hatchet Man, How Bill Barr Broke the Prosecutor's Code and Corrupted the Justice Department. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eli Honig.
Ian, thank you for having me. Always glad to join you.
Well, thanks, Eli. And the Justice Department on Wednesday referred the former acting Washington U.S. attorney, and of course the U.S. attorney's office in Washington is the largest in the country, Michael Sherwin, who did an unapproved interview on CBS's 60 Minutes last Sunday about the many, many cases that the government is now bringing against the rioters. He's been referred to the DOJ's Office of Professional Responsibility. So just to go back to your forthcoming book, Hatchet Man, How Bill Barr Broke the Prosecutor's Code and Corrupted the Justice Department, what do you know about what went on with Bill Barr and Trump in appointing this Michael Sherwin from Florida, apparently because he dealt with the case of the Saudis shooting American servicemen on a base where they're being trained? Frankly, from my point of view, if Trump liked what he had done as the U.S. attorney down in Florida, then I'm a little suspicious because we know Trump and Kushner have such a tight relationship with the Saudis. So what is it about Michael Sherwin that Bill Barr and Donald Trump noticed in order to promote him to this very prestigious position?
So as a general rule, Donald Trump understood and Bill Barr understood that personnel is policy, or personnel trumps policy, no pun intended, in some instances. The number one example of that was Donald Trump choosing Bill Barr. The reason he chose Bill Barr, I argue in the book, is because Bill Barr openly forecasted to the world that he was going to cover up for Donald Trump on the Mueller case. Why they together chose Sherwin, I don't think we know exactly. It could be related to the case you're talking about. Remember, though, this happened before January 6th. Now, Sherwin then sort of took charge of the group that was putting together the January 6th cases. Now, where he's at now, Sherwin is no longer supervising the January 6th prosecutions, but he still works for DOJ. And that's why his move of giving this sit-down interview to 60 Minutes was so inappropriate. It was a violation both of the written rules of DOJ and the norms. And by the way, this is what I credit Bill Barr for throughout the book. The rule is a very sound and fairly obvious one, which is prosecutors may not comment publicly on pending investigations. Not only did Sherwin do that, he gave essentially his own opinion on those cases, which have not yet been charged. It's completely inappropriate. It's indefensible that he did it. I was shocked when I saw it. The way I was trained at DOJ was always, if you ever get a call from the media, which would happen sometimes, I would do some cases that were in the papers, all you say is no comment, call the press office. And then they call the press office, and then the press office would officially give it a no comment. So the fact that this guy, Sherwin, sat with 60 Minutes and gave a detailed, lengthy interview is a really bad move. It could prejudice the cases. It could endanger the cases. And he now, rightly, will be subject to internal discipline.
But just going back to his tenure after having been chosen by Barr and Trump, didn't he have something to do with Barr's efforts to help out Roger Stone and Mike Flynn?
Yeah, so at various points, Barr inserted various sort of loyalists to do his bidding when it came to Stone and Flynn. Some resisted, some didn't. I think Sherwin was part of that group as well. It all came out at the end that, I mean, it wasn't ever really a state secret, but all of these interventions, these unusual interventions being done in the Stone and Flynn case, were being done at Barr's behest and instruction. So, yeah, I mean, look, Sherwin, I think, you know, I'm reluctant to just sort of brand someone a loyalist and that's that, because anyone chooses any president, any attorney general chooses people who they trust, know, believe in, and often share the same ideology. I don't have a problem with that. Where I have a problem is if you think someone's in the bag or someone's going to go along with things that are just utterly improper. So Sherwin's role in all that, I guess, is to be determined.
Well, it is a legitimate concern, though, given Barr and Trump's record.
Sure. I mean, look, like I said, Donald Trump viewed DOJ fundamentally different from, I think, any other modern president, in that he viewed DOJ as basically his own law firm, his own legal operation, that the only goal, Donald Trump could never quite understand this idea that here's DOJ, they're part of the executive branch, I'm head of the executive branch, everything they do should be for me. And that is not how DOJ works. That's not what DOJ has been about. Different presidents have approached DOJ differently and had different levels of sort of hands off. But Trump just said, I own you. You worked for me, which is just wrong. And Bill Barr, I don't even say went along with that. Bill Barr sort of eagerly inserted DOJ into politics, the Michael Flynn case, the Roger Stone case, the Mueller case, and many other sort of less high profile incidents. So I think they both together really abused DOJ and broke what I call the prosecutor's code. And by the way, a big part of my theory for why is Bill Barr, I argue, is a pretender. He's not a real prosecutor. He never was. Unlike his predecessors and his successor, unlike John Ashcroft, unlike Eric Holder, unlike Loretta Lynch, unlike Michael Mukasey, and now Merrick Garland, all of them came up through DOJ's ranks. They all know what it means to be a prosecutor. They all were trained in the best traditions of DOJ. Bill Barr, of course, had been AG once before in the early 90s, but he never tried a case in his life as a prosecutor. And I think as a result of that, he never understood what DOJ was really about. And that sort of led to him abusing and misusing DOJ.
And again, I'm speaking with Ellie Honig, who served as an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York for 8 years and as the director of the Division of Criminal Justice at the Office of the Attorney General of the State of New Jersey for 5 years. He's currently executive director at Rutgers Institute for Secure Communities and a legal analyst for CNN. And he is the author of the forthcoming book, Hatchet Man, How Bill Barr Broke the Prosecutor's Code and Corrupted the Justice Department. So you, as a former assistant U.S. attorney and prosecutor, Ellie, you were appalled. Everybody that's been on television talking heads from DOJ and in the legal profession are also appalled at what Michael Sherwin did simply by appearing on 60 Minutes. One of the critiques I've heard, though, is, and in the interview, of course, Michael Sherwin talked about how he was there at the rally that day when Trump told, essentially, sicked the executive branch on the legislative branch and told the thousands of his followers to head to the Capitol. He was there in his jogging clothes watching the whole thing. And some people have commented that, well, my God, you're the chief law enforcement guy in Washington, D.C. You shouldn't be hanging out with these insurrectionists. You should be protecting the Capitol. How did it strike you?
That part of the interview was absolutely bizarre. I mean, Sherwin had this strange story where he was kind of ambivalent or ambiguous about, he said something like he was in his jogging clothes. So, okay, wait, did you just happen to be out for a jog, or were you trying to do some sort of undercover work, which of course is inappropriate? That's not a prosecutor's job. That's a cop's job, an FBI agent's job. So he was very, I think everybody did a double and triple take when they heard that. What is he doing there? And the reason, among many others, the reason you don't go to a scene like that is exactly this scenario. If something like this breaks out and happens, now what do you do? I mean, you're an AUSA. Well, he's the U.S. attorney. You're a prosecutor. You're not a cop. You don't carry handcuffs. You don't carry a gun. You can't start arresting people. But I mean, I think as soon as he realized that crimes were being committed, and again, it depends where he was and when. If he was at the rally, I mean, there were no crimes, you know, directly physically committed at the Ellipse. You know, the break-in happened a little bit after that. But if you witness anything criminal or potentially criminal, you have a duty to report that, to call the FBI immediately. So he, you know, what he was doing there, why he was there, I'm not satisfied with his explanation. I think he put himself into a really bad situation, and it doesn't sound like he handled it right either.
So on Tuesday, D.C. District Judge Amit Mehta warned the DOJ and defense attorneys for the 10 defendants in the Oath Keepers conspiracy in the Capitol Hill riot case. And he also said the government, quite frankly, in my view, should know better. And this case will not be tried in the media. So obviously he's annoyed with Sherwin as well. But the defense attorneys for the Oath Keepers, one of them said that he thought the comments from Mr. Sherwin were very prejudicial. So did Sherwin in any way, either why, grandstanding, stupidity, I don't know what the motives might be, but what are the consequences? Is it going to be harder to try these Oath Keepers and others?
Yeah, so a couple of things. First of all, the direct consequence to Sherwin is he's now being investigated internally within DOJ by the disciplinary apparatus, which is absolutely appropriate. When it comes time to try this case, you're going to have two problems. One is, and I think we're already starting to see this, that the defense lawyers are going to move to dismiss the indictments. They're going to argue this was prosecutorial misconduct. It was done obviously intentionally. It was done to prejudice the potential jury, to inflame people against my client based on things that he's not been charged for. So I think you're going to have that motion, that wave of motions to dismiss. I don't think a judge is likely to grant those motions and to dismiss the charges, but you know, now you have to fight a battle that you didn't have to fight before. The other thing is, when it comes time to select a jury in this case, and we're seeing it a bit with the Derek Chauvin jury in Minneapolis right now, you have to vet your jurors. You don't have to find jurors who've never heard of this. I mean, how could you ever find jurors who've never heard of Derek Chauvin and George Floyd? How could you find jurors who've never heard of January 6th? But you have to find jurors who are able to be fair and impartial. And if you have jurors saying, well, I saw that 60 Minutes interview with that prosecutor, it sure as heck looked like these guys are guilty, you're going to lose those jurors. And it's going to make jury selection more complicated for everybody involved. So there's, and then lastly, I should just say, it's completely unbecoming for a prosecutor. This is not what prosecutors do. You don't get out there and fan flames. We used to say, you do your talking in court. You do your talking through your indictment. You do your talking when you're addressing the jury or the judge, but you don't go off outside of the courtroom and make statements, especially on a pending case like this.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Ellie Honig, how is the replacement doing? Channing Phillips, he used to have that job, didn't he?
Sure. The replacement at the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office.
Yeah, replacing Sherwin, yeah.
Yeah, I guess the answer is TBD, to be determined. You know, to me, there's a couple big tests here. Are they going to bring the more serious charges, what I consider the more serious charges, including potentially sedition charges? We've not seen a sedition charge yet, but I think that sedition actually really fits here. You hear that term sedition, you think of this dramatic, you know, attempts to overthrow the government. That is one definition of sedition, arguably applicable here. But there's also much simpler, sort of lesser versions of sedition under the federal law. It can include attempting to interfere with a governmental process, here the counting of the electoral ballots, or even forcibly seizing or taking over a government building without permission. So, I mean, I think we all saw that happening quite clearly. So, A, is the new U.S. attorney going to bring those more serious charges? And B, will he make good on the Attorney General Merrick Garland's promise? When Merrick Garland was confirmed just 2 weeks ago now only, he testified that he would follow all leads from the people who are on the ground on up the chain. And I think it's essential that DOJ investigate and, if appropriate, prosecute anyone who was involved in the planning, the plotting, or even the incitement of this riot, up to and including, and I'm talking about investigating here in a serious way, but up to and including Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani, and others. So that'll ultimately, to me, tell the tale of whether this new U.S. attorney is doing his job.
And just in closing, will Trump and Giuliani say that Sherwin prejudiced the jury?
That's an interesting, I'm sure they will. I mean, I'm sure any defendant who gets charged from here on out will, you know, that has anything to do with the contents of Michael Sherwin's interview will make that argument. It's a little harder maybe for Donald Trump or Rudy Giuliani because they're already so high profile. But sure, I expect every defendant charged from here on out to at least try to make that argument. Sherwin has created a real headache for DOJ by his actions.
Well, Ellie Honig, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ellie Honig, who served as the Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York for 8 years and as Director of the Division of Criminal Justice at the Office of the Attorney General of the State of New Jersey for 5 years. He's currently Executive Director at Rutgers Institute for Secure Communities and a legal analyst for CNN. And he's the author of the forthcoming book, Hatchet Man, How Bill Barr Broke the Prosecutor's Code and Corrupted the Justice Department. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now. Stay